You're attending session 233 titled John W. Woolley is a highly trusted Mormon from September 1886 to December 1913. Please turn off your cell phones. It's going to be recorded so you can buy it afterwards in the front. It's being presented by D. Michael Quinn, and he needs no introduction that I know of. Take it away.
This title's first date was the month and year when LDS Church's president, John Taylor, a defiant polygamist, began hiding in the house of monogamist John W. Woolley in Centerville, Davis County, north of Salt Lake City. For a year and a half, federal deputies had been raiding houses throughout Utah Territory in an effort to arrest Mormonism's highest leader. His concealment in Woolley's house was 4 years to the month before the LDS president's successor, Wilfred Woodruff, issued the 1890 manifesto. It concluded, quote, "And I now publicly declare that my advice to the Latter-day Saints is to refrain from contracting any marriage forbidden by the law of the land," unquote. Decades later, Lawrence C. Woolley described otherworldly events that occurred at his father's house during 26-27 September 1886, which became the basis for claims of special authority to continue performing plural marriages by those now called fundamentalist Mormons. John Taylor allegedly ordained Samuel Bateman, George Q. Cannon, Charles H. Wilkin, John W. Woolley, and Lauren as High Priest Apostles on 27 September 1886, also commissioning them to keep alive plural marriage even if the LDS Church gave it up. Lauren's account in the 1920s continued, quote, "The Prophet Joseph Smith stood by directing the proceedings. Two of us had not met the Prophet Joseph Smith in his mortal lifetime, and we, Charles H. Wilkin and myself, were introduced to him and shook hands with him," unquote. Upon Joseph F. Smith's return from Hawaii to Utah in 1887, he was likewise ordained and commissioned according to Lauren. December 1913 was when John W. Woolley was honorably released from his stake high council after 36 years of service. For a few weeks, he continued in two other LDS positions, as a set-apart ordinance worker in the Salt Lake Temple and as an ordained patriarch in the Davis stake. However, by mid-January 1942, the 82-year-old was under scrutiny by LDS headquarters for recently performing polygamous marriages. The Deseret News announced that the Quorum of the 12 Apostles excommunicated him in March. As a publishing historian, I've done my best to verify from written documents and to describe from historical context what actually happened regarding various controversies in Mormonism's past. By emphasizing the earliest documents available to me instead of depending primarily on decades later assertions, my approach has often revised what various individuals, families, religious leaders, and previous historians have claimed. Today's presentation is typical of that process as I itemize John W. Woolley's activities within the church he loved. This requires your patience in listening to one factoid or quote after another as I present his religious devotion and prominence before he became controversial. To fit within the time allotted today, this omits many of my findings. On 1 September 1886, the diary of the First Presidency's first counselor, George Q. Cannon, states that guard Charles H. Wilkin returned to President John Taylor's hiding place in the Salt Lake County and, quote, "had found a suitable place of hiding in Davis County. Brother John W. Woolley, the eldest son of the late Edwin D. Woolley, whose residence is about 12 miles north of the city, would be glad to accommodate us, unquote. On September 8th, Cannon's original diary had a long entry, quote, about John Q., unquote. His son, who had been excommunicated 3 days earlier for adultery. This is the first of numerous pages that someone, probably after the first counselor's death, tore from his diary for several dates during September, October 1886. For example, two pages are missing from George Q's diary for entries from September 10th to midway through September 16th. On September 15th, guard Samuel Bateman wrote in his own diary that John Taylor and other bodyguards arrived at Woolley's house in Centerville at 1 o'clock a.m. That was an event obviously now absent from Cannon's torn-up diary, which later specified that these guards armed themselves with loaded shotguns while George Q. had a revolver. For Sunday, 26 September 1886, the diary of the First Presidency's secretary, L. John Nuttall, states, quote, "All is well this morning, President Cannon being some better in his health. This morning, Presidents Taylor and Cannon and Elders Hiram B. Clausen and Nuttall met, and Brother Clausen reported his trip to Eureka Tintic. At 2:30 p.m., held our usual meeting, including Brothers Joseph E. Taylor, who came during that night. Bishop Clausen was also in meeting with us. Bishop Clausen was requested to take charge of the meeting. After singing, Brother Joseph E. Taylor prayed. Bishop Clausen made a few remarks, and he and Brother J.E. Taylor administered the sacrament. Brothers J.E. Taylor, C.H. Wilkin, S. Bateman, L.J. Nuttall, President Cannon, John Woolley, C.H. Beryl, and President Taylor each spoke. A very good meeting was enjoyed and President Cannon dismissed," unquote. Aside from changes in punctuation, this became the First Presidency Office Journal. With more details concerning September 26, Cannon's diary states in full, quote, "I had greatly improved in health today. We had sent for Brother H.B. Clausen to come out on important business that required immediate attention. We spent the forenoon conversing with him upon it. Among other things was the political affairs of our people in Arizona. At 2:30, we held our meeting. Brother Joseph E. Taylor and wife joined us, she being in the underground, and he having coming out to visit her today. There were 9 elders present and 3 sisters, President Taylor and myself, Elder Joseph E. Taylor, Bishop H.B. Clausen, Elders Nuttall, Wilkin, Bateman, John Woolley, and Beryl, Sisters Woolley and daughter, and Sister Taylor. Our meeting was a very interesting one," unquote. For Monday, 27 September 1886, John Nuttall's diary states, quote, "President Cannon still improving in his health. The rest of the party are all well. President Taylor signed several recommends. A letter was received from Elder F.D. Richards. Note, I'm omitting the contents of this day's letters as described by Nuttall. A letter was received from Brother A. Minor. A letter was received from Brother William M. Palmer. A letter was received from Sister Ellen Norwood Billingsley. A letter was written to Elder Enoch Farr. A letter was also sent to Brother Thomas G. Weber. A letter was written to President Wilfred Woodruff. President Taylor pitched quoits a while this morning, also in the afternoon. President Cannon in house most of the day. He sat out of doors a while in the after part of the day. Brother Bateman carried in our mail matter," unquote. Aside from changes in punctuation and spelling, this became the First Presidency's office journal for this date. Now note, quoits was a European game in which rings of rope or flattened metal are thrown at an upright peg. By the 20th century, Americans more often called it ring toss. Then someone tore 3 pages from Cannon's diary that covered the period from one paragraph about the morning of September 29th until the last lines about the night of October 12th. It is inconceivable that every entry for those 14 days involved the painfully recent excommunication of his son, John Q. But we'll never know all the matters that were concealed when ripped from his father's diary. Nonetheless, one of the torn-out events in Cannon's diaries was the polygamous marriage on 4 October 1886 of 50-year-old John W. Woolley and 59-year-old Ann Reed Everington Roberts Nichols Dustin. Having children was obviously not the purpose of their ceremony. Any historian would ask why Woolley suddenly married a plural wife after 34 years of ignoring the 1852 publication of Joseph Smith's Revelation on Plural Marriage, after ignoring Brigham Young's emphatic sermons from 1853 to 1857 for monogamous to marry polygamously during the so-called Utah Reformation, after nearly 4 years of ignoring the 1882 publication of John Taylor's Revelation that advocated plural marriage for presiding officers, which caused a stake president to resign in 1882, and after ignoring John Taylor's public ultimatums during 1884 to 85 for all monogamists in presiding offices to quickly marry polygamously or resign, causing the resignation of more stake presidents who are monogamists. One explanation for Woolley's sudden conversion to entering plural marriage is a document in the handwriting of John Taylor, dated September 27, 1886. It states in full, "My son John," quote, "My son John, you have asked me concerning the new and everlasting covenant, how far it is binding upon my people. Thus saith the Lord, all commandments that I give must be obeyed by those calling themselves by my name, unless they are revoked by me or by my authority. And how can I revoke an everlasting covenant? For I, the Lord, am everlasting, and my everlasting covenants cannot be abrogated nor done away with, but they stand forever. Have I not given my word in great plainness on this subject? And yet have not great numbers of my people been negligent in the observance of my law and the keeping of my commandment? And yet have I borne with them these many years, and this because of their weakness, because of the perilous times. And furthermore, it is more pleasing to me that men should use their free agency in regard to these matters. Nevertheless, I, the Lord, do not change, and my word and my covenants and my law do not. And as I have heretofore said by my servant Joseph, all those who would enter into my glory must and shall obey my law. And have I not commanded men that if they were Abraham's seed and would enter into my glory, they must do the works of Abraham? I have not revoked this law, nor will I, for it is everlasting. And those who will enter into my glory must obey the conditions thereof, ever so. Amen." Unquote. From the 1930s onward, but not before the 1930s, church leaders and LDS historians have questioned or actually denounced the authenticity of that document. However, decades before this 1886 revelation became controversial to other Mormons, Apostle John W. Taylor referred to it during the meetings of the Quorum of the Twelve on 2 October 1889, on 30 September 1890, and on 1 April 1892. Joseph Fielding Smith, then an assistant church historian, made his own copy of it in 1909. 34 years after the September 1886 revelation, Lawrence C. Woolley is first recorded as claiming that a special meeting for ordaining and commissioning occurred at his father's residence. I have found no evidence for those 1886 ordinations before diary entries in 1904 and 1906, which I'll quote later. Now to resume fall of 1886 in Cannon's diary. On November 26, 22nd, it states, quote, "We left a little after 6 and drove to Brother Woolley's. We found that President Taylor and party had gone to the place which had been selected as our new stopping place, the house of Brother Thomas F. Rusha, northward in Kaysville, Davis County. We followed on and reached there about 11 o'clock, unquote. On the 27th, Cannon's diary states that his son, Abraham H. Cannon, quote, "is the bearer of an important letter from Brother John W. Young, and also some verbal communications. I arranged to have an interview with him, Abraham, at Brother Woolley's," unquote. Even though Counselor Cannon and President Taylor had moved to Rusha's house, John W. Woolley's remained a secure location for their secret meetings with other Mormons. On 19 December 1886, John Taylor, age 78, married Josephine Rusha, age 26, the ceremony performed by her father. This was the first polygamous marriage that Taylor entered in violation of federal laws enacted since 1862. Again, any historian would ask what caused him to do this 30 years after he married his previous wife in 1856. For me, the obvious answer is that the September 1886 revelation prompted John Taylor to again marry polygamously. On 5 February 1887, Cannon's diary states, quote, "Brother Bateman and myself drove to Brother Woolley's about 3:30 a.m. Brother Franklin S. Richards and myself spent the day together, and he described fully the conduct of affairs in Washington. He thought that we might, without committing ourselves and denying our principles, adopt a constitution prohibiting polygamy and bigamy," unquote. Thus, John W. Woolley was on the premises when the first presidency's attorney discussed with George Q. Cannon the plan to make significant compromise about plural marriage. On March 25th, at Davis Stakes priesthood meeting, High Councilman Woolley remarked that, quote, "much has been said in private in regard to the test oath that has been administered to some of the brethren to obey the 1882 Federal Edmunds Act against polygamous cohabitation and polygamy. Territorial Central Committee of the LDS Church's People's Party," continuing what Woolley was saying, "have sought advice and think it proper for the monogamous who can take the oath, who are holding office now, political office, to take it. In June, a chance will probably be given all of us to subscribe to the oath. And in regard to taking it, each one can do as he pleases. After we have done all we can, the Lord will come to our assistance," unquote, of Woolley's remarks. On 4 May 1887, Cannon's diary states, quote, "Brother J.W. Woolley has been with us since Brother C.H. Wilkin left on May 2nd. He returned to his home this evening," unquote. During John Taylor's life in hiding since early 1885, Wilkin served as his chief bodyguard, and John W. Woolley substituted for Wilkin during these days of his absence. On 13 July 1887, Nuttall's diary states, quote, "we are informed that Brother H.B. Clausen is coming out to the halfway house, Brother John W. Woolley's, this evening," unquote. On July 16th, Cannon's diary states, quote, "I called at the house of Brother John W. Woolley and explained to him that I anticipated Brother Joseph F. Smith would be at Brother Barnard White's and wished him to go there, as it had been arranged between his cousin, Brother A.W. Davis, and himself to meet them and direct them to our place of abode," unquote. On July 18th at the Rusha House, Guard Samuel Bateman wrote, quote, "this afternoon, Joseph F. Smith arrived here from the Hawaiian Islands. Brother Albert Davis went and met him up in Idaho Territory. Brother John Woolley met them at Brigham City and brought them here," unquote. For that day, Nuttall's diary states, quote, "after greeting these brethren, Presidents Cannon and Smith went into the president's room and were with him, and they alone. Therefore, what Nuttall wrote was not what he observed, but what he was told about what happened when those three were alone in John Taylor's room. When President Cannon, continuing quote, when President Cannon told President Taylor of Brother Joseph F.'s arrival and presence, and that now the First Presidency are again together for the first time since September 1884, President Taylor said, though scarcely conscious, "I feel to thank the Lord." He appeared to recognize President Smith. After remaining for a short time, Brothers Davis and Woolley also went in to see the president, but he scarcely recognized them, unquote. July 18, 1887 was the last day that John W. Woolley saw John Taylor alive. According to the detailed list of attenders in the Nuttall and Bateman diaries, none of the Woolleys were at the church president's deathbed on July 25th. For 21 December 1887, the posting of Cannon's diary by LDS headquarters has a footnote from the editors. Quote, "At this point, there are approximately 72 words redacted," unquote. Without an editorial statement about the subject matter of the deleted entry, this raises suspicion about censorship so close to the one-year anniversary of John Taylor's written revelation about plural marriage. Censorship has a backfiring effect. During October 1887, Joseph F. Smith moved his plural wife, Sarah Richard Smith, to Woolley's house, and Cannon's diary stated on November 4th, unquote, "It had been the intention of President Woodruff to go north on a visit to Brother Joseph F. Smith, who had moved to the residence of Brother John W. Woolley at Centerville," unquote. On January 27, 1887, at Davis Stakes Priesthood Meeting, High Councilman Woolley said, quote, "None of us is in full fellowship unless he is keeping all the commandments of God," unquote. During times of intense opposition against polygamy, all the commandments was one of the codes that faithful Mormons used for plural marriage. Between the Deseret News publication of Wolford Woodruff's manifesto on 25 December 1890, and the adoption of Joseph F. Smith's so-called second manifesto by General Conference on 6 April 1904, more than 250 plural marriages were secretly performed by 21 LDS officials. In my examination of the diaries, autobiographies, and family traditions of the participants in those 250 ceremonies, none claimed that they had consulted John W. Woolley beforehand. This included his nieces, Jeanette Marie Woolley Taylor, Mary Elizabeth Woolley Chamberlain, and Fanny Woolley Parkinson. Living in John W. Woolley's house, his unmarried daughter, Amy, wrote in her diary on 3 February 1891, quote, "This evening, Brother J.F. Smith, wife, two daughters and a son, with Brother C.H. Wilkin, come to see us. We had a very nice visit. They went back to the city the very same night," unquote. On April 20th, by his pseudonym Jason Mack, Joseph F. Smith wrote to John W. Woolley as, quote, "My dear Captain," in part, quote, "I know of no place and no friends to whom I can look with more confidence than Camp Solitude and you," unquote. Woolley had served as captain in several capacities, first in the 384-wagon church train that left Utah in May 1863 with food for the poor emigrants in Nebraska. Second, for a company of emigrants arriving in Salt Lake City on 4 October 1863, and third, in the Mormon militia during the 1865-67 Black Hawk War in southern Utah. Camp Solitude was code for Woolley's house, where Joseph F.'s plural wife, Sarah Richard Smith, began hiding in 1887, and where his plural wife, Edna Lamson Smith, began hiding in 1889. On 7 June 1891, George Q. Cannon's diary stated that after attending Davis Stakes' quarterly conference, quote, "I went in company with Brother C.H. Wilkin to Brother John W. Woolley's. I decided to pay my respects to him and his family because of the kindness which they had shown to me while I was on the underground, President Taylor and myself having stopped there for a number of weeks. My recollection of their home produced mingled feelings. It recalled sorrowful days and nights which I had in consequence of my son John Q's affair. And it recalled also many pleasant hours which I had enjoyed with the family and the brethren. It was here that I was attacked with a sort of bilious colic which came very near killing me." That's an intestinal problem, which he described in detail in his diary, but I eliminated it here. "Brother John W. Woolley took me to the train," unquote. The diary never mentions him again during the 10 years before Cannon died. Even when the presidency's counselor spoke at upcoming meetings of Davis Stake, he didn't record visiting Woolley. On the other hand, George Q. Cannon's diaries make no reference whatever to his private endorsements of post-manifesto polygamy that other manuscripts show him giving to several apostles and regular Mormons. This includes conversations described in the diaries of his son, Abraham H. Cannon, of Apostle George Teasdale, of Apostle Abraham Owen Woodruff, and of temple worker Joseph H. Dean. Those gaps allow for similar concealment in George Q. Cannon's diaries of secret meetings between him and John W. Woolley. On 14 June 1891, daughter Amy Woolley wrote, quote, "Apostle Joseph F. Smith, wife and child, C.H. Wilkin and S. Sudbury came. They spent the evening and we had a very nice time," unquote. On September 4th, she wrote, "After we had all retired, Brother J.F. Smith, wife and daughter, and Brother Albert Davis came. We made them comfortable, then went to bed again," unquote. She returned to her bedroom, but John W. Woolley, as host, certainly stayed up longer to talk with the just-arrived counselor in the First Presidency. Likewise, the next morning, Amy wrote, quote, "On account of our company's coming, we did not go to state conference today, but visited with them until afternoon when they left." On 2 March 1892, Amy wrote, quote, "This morning, Pa and Ma went to the city to attend a social at Brother Joseph F. Smith's," unquote. On March 5th, she wrote, "Brother Joseph F. Smith and wife and Charles Wilkins spent the night here," unquote. On March 22nd, First Presidency Secretary wrote, "President Joseph F. Smith returned from Centerville and reported that Sister Julia Ensign Woolley, wife of Brother John W. Woolley, died this morning at 6 o'clock. At Brother Smith's request, I telephoned the news to Brother Samuel W. Woolley at Grantsville and to Brother Abraham, President Abraham Hatch, at Heber City, and telegraphed the news to Brother Hiram S. Woolley in Paris, Idaho, and to E.D. Woolley, Jr. at Kanab," unquote. The First Presidency's second counselor was such a close friend of John W. Woolley that Joseph F. Smith instructed Nuttall to give the fastest notification possible to three of John's brothers and to one brother-in-law. On 5 October 1892, Amy Woolley wrote, quote, "Brother C.H. Wilkin and Joseph F. Smith and two ladies came and visited us this evening," unquote. On 18 February 1893, she wrote, quote, "On the 9th of this month, Brothers Joseph F. Smith and wife L. and L. John Nuttall and wife and A.W. Davis and wife and C.H. Wilkin and daughter gave us a pleasant surprise. When I came home from school, they were all here. They spent the evening and then returned to the city," unquote. Altogether, from February 1891 to the end of her diary in February 1893, Amy recorded 8 days when her father socialized with the First Presidency's counselor. This averaged 4 times a year. and John W. Woolley's personal interactions with Joseph F. Smith were probably as frequent thereafter. On 28 August 1894, Woolley became a set-apart ordnance worker in the Salt Lake Temple. On 25 January 1897, Mission President Andrew Kimball wrote what Lawrence C. Woolley preached as a short-time missionary in Arkansas. Quote, "He knew that the prophets Joseph, Brigham, and Heber lived, for he had seen them, as they appeared to President John Taylor in Brother John Woolley's house," unquote. On 28 March 1897, the missionary diary of Byron Harvey Allred, Jr. described another branch's meeting. Quote, "Elder L.C. Woolley spoke of the power and authority of the priesthood, bearing a great testimony to the people of the divine calling of the prophet Joseph Smith, saying he had seen him personally since his, the prophet's, death," unquote. These missionary diaries of January and March 1897 have been the earliest known recordings of anyone's statements about miraculous events at Woolley's home, where John Taylor stayed only one time, from September 1886 to late November. Both diaries emphasize the sensational claim Lauren made three decades later that he, when meeting with pro-polygamy Mormons, that he had met with the resurrected Joseph Smith. On 28 April 1901, at the South Bountiful War, John W. Woolley said, quote, "He desired to do as those told by those over him in the priesthood," unquote. On 16 February 1902, at the East Bountiful Ward, he said, quote, "We ought not to go to the temple of the Lord unless we believe all the commandments," unquote. Again, code. Between the adoption of Joseph Smith's second manifesto in April 1904 and a ceremony in July 1907, more than 30 new polygamous marriages were secretly performed by 11 LDS officials. In my examination of the diaries, autobiographies, and family traditions of the participants in those second manifesto ceremonies, none involved John W. Woolley in any way. The husbands included his nephew, Samuel E. Woolley, a mission president. Nevertheless, on 8 October 1904, Apostle Reed Smoot's secretary in Washington, D.C., confided to his diary, quote, "A.B. Irvine told me that Apostle Abraham Owen Woodruff told him that a certain number of worthy people had been commissioned to keep alive the principle of plural marriage. This was in references to the new marriages about which gossip was rife," unquote. Alonzo Blair Irvine had married a daughter of George Buchanan in 1898. Likewise, 18 months after Irvine's disclosure, a different Mormon diarist wrote, quote, "President Taylor died in exile for this principle, and he gave men authority to perform the ceremony of marriage, which authority I have been told was never revoked," unquote. These two diary entries during the U.S. Senate's investigation of post-manifesto polygamy were consistent with Lawrence C. Woolley's claims 14 years later about September 1886. However, those diaries did not specify nor even imply which man John Taylor commissioned before his death in 1887 to keep alive the principle of plural marriage. The unnamed officiators could have been pre-1887 temple presidents, like Mariner W. Merrill, who performed post-manifesto ceremonies and married a plural wife himself in 1901, and could have been pre-1887 members of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, like John W. Taylor, who did the same. Therefore, the quoted diaries do not prove Lauren's subsequent assertions that he and his father received an ordination commission from John Taylor during September 1886. However, multiple consistencies strengthen the probability of an alleged event that lacks contemporary verification. On 23 June 1906, recently released opossum Matthias F. Cowley made the earliest verified distribution to a rank-and-file Mormon of, quote, a copy of the revelation given to President John Taylor, September 27, 1886, on the new and everlasting covenant, unquote. On 22 July 1906, at the East Bountiful Ward, quote, John Woolley said he thought there was a great responsibility placed upon his shoulders and prayed God to bless all, unquote. On April 7, 1907, Apostle Heber J. Grant asked Woolley to give the opening prayer at General Conference's overflow session in the Assembly Hall. Its speakers included Warra's Stakes President, Anthony W. Ivins, who had officiated for more than 40 polygamous marriages in Mexico from 1897 to 1904. 6 months later, on October 6th, Apostle Roger Clausen asked Woolley to give the opening prayer at the General Conference's overflow session in the Assembly Hall. Its speakers included two post-manifesto polygamists, Stake President William H. Smart and Stake President Walter C. Lyman. Like Lyman, Apostle Clausen had married a wife several months after the Second Manifesto of 1904. On 14 June 1908, Stake missionary Lawrence C. Woolley, quote, spoke on the marriage subject, unquote, at the West Bountiful Ward, where Stake High Councilman John W. Woolley, quote, said it was proper to do what was right, even if you made enemies doing so, unquote. On 2 March 1909, formerly Ward Bishopric Counselor David W. Jeffs and second wife Nettie Lenora Timpson were married in Salt Lake City by Davis Stake Patriarch Judson Tolman. Jeffs wrote that he was introduced to Tolman for this polygamous marriage through John W. Woolley, uncle of Jeff's first wife. During April 1909, according to her sister, Stake High Councilman Victor C. Hegstead and fourth wife Anna Sophia Jacobson were married in Salt Lake City, allegedly by John W. Woolley. I think it is more likely that he referred Hegstead to Patriarch Tolman, as was the case a month earlier with David Jeffs, and that it was Tolman who actually officiated for Hegstead's polygamous marriage. On June 20th at the Clearfield Ward, quote, High Counselor John W. Woolley said that he knew the President, Joseph F. Smith, had enemies who professed to be good Latter-day Saints, unquote. On 23 March 1910, President Smith performed a licensed marriage in the Salt Lake Temple for 78-year-old Woolley and 39-year-old Annie Fisher as his third wife. This monogamous ceremony occurred only 2 months following the death of his previous wife, Ann Everington Roberts Nichols Dustin. And Woolley might have intended to duplicate the example of 78-year-old John Taylor marrying a decades younger wife after the 1886 revelation. On the other hand, aside from the speed of this widower's legal remarriage, there is some evidence that he secretly married Annie in 1908 while his 1886 wife was still living. On 29 October 1910, he was at the Davis Stakes High Council meeting when Stake President Joseph H. Grant, quote, gave a detailed statement of the case of Patriarch Judson Tolman, who had had several hearings before the Council of the 12 Apostles and had by them been excommunicated from the church for solemnizing plural marriages. All the brethren of the High Council expressed themselves as upholding the Council of the Apostles and First Presidency in what they had done in regard to those who had lately gone into or performed polygamous marriages, unquote. Woolley was one of the High Councilmen who verbally approved Tolman's excommunication. In late October or thereabout, Local 70's President Ephraim A. Meekum and second wife Helen Grace Pratt Thompson were married in Salt Lake City, probably performed by John W. Woolley. They had individually consulted about this polygamous marriage on October 16th and 17th with stake president William H. Smart, the post-manifesto polygamist who spoke at the General Conference overflow meeting for which Woolley prayed 3 years earlier. In 1910 or 11, local 70s president Joseph R. Jepson and second wife Leah Woolley were married, probably by her great uncle, John W. Woolley. The marriage ended by 1912 when she became the monogamous wife of another man. This is the next. There is no probabilities about. This definitely happened. By mid-January 1911, Henrietta Woolley Simmons witnessed her brother, John W. Woolley, perform the polygamous marriage in Salt Lake City for her daughter, Alice Simmons Taysom, and his son, Lauren C. Woolley. It was Lauren's first polygamous wife. Henrietta died on 13 January 1911, and Alice's daughter by first marriage confided those details. On 26 February 1911, about a month afterward, John W. Woolley spoke at the Kaysville Ward. The Salt Lake Telegraph newspaper reported that, quote, some of those who were at the meeting believe that the sermon was a strong plea in favor of polygamy and a covert encouragement to the good Mormons to practice it, unquote. Excuse me. Before 10 May 1911, when ex-apostle Matthias F. Cowley denied officiating for Lulu Johnson, Elders Quorum Counselor Peter K. Lemon Jr. and second wife Lucy Lulu Ann Johnson Fillerup were married polygamously in Centerville by John W. Woolley, who later disclosed this to the apostles. Again, there is no probability about that except for the date, which is specifically unknown. In mid-1911, or thereabout, local 70s president and second wife Helen Malvina Morgan were married, probably by Woolley. In April 1912, branch president George W. Tolley and second wife Zoe Cole were married in Centerville by John W. Woolley. Again, no probability, except the exact date in April is not known. That month, stake high councilman Bar W. Musser and second wife Mary Eliza Lance were married in Salt Lake City, probably by Woolley. On 1 May 1912, again, there's no question about this, while conversing about plural marriages performed since the second manifesto, a daily diarist wrote that church president Joseph F. Smith confided, quote, it is hard to make some people see the difference between cases, that you will permit this one, but won't or cannot that one, unquote. 4 years earlier, President Smith had permitted this diarist to seek a new plural wife, quote, but to be careful in writing, unquote. From October 1910 until 1912, John W. Woolley was the only one performing plural marriages. Because President Smith confided in May 1912 that he had permitted recent plural marriages, it's not a stretch to conclude that he authorized Woolley to perform those occurring after Tolman's excommunication. Although it is possible to historically disprove false allegations about past events, it seems significant that no available sources written before 1920 cast doubt on two of Lauren Woolley's claims from that year onward. Available sources demonstrate, first, that LDS President John Taylor received and transcribed a revelation about plural marriage in late September of 1886, and second, that less than 11 years later, Lauren spoke publicly about Joseph Smith and other resurrected beings appearing at John W. Woolley's home while President Taylor was there. Furthermore, the available pre-1920 sources tend to support Lauren's third claim during the 1920s, that John Taylor ordained, commissioned men in 1886 to preserve plural marriage, no matter what policy the LDS Church might adopt after his death. On the other hand, crucial insights are within documents still sequestered within vaults inside church LDS headquarters. Examples are George Q. Cannon's private memorandum book, mentioned but not included in his journals that have been posted on the internet by LDS headquarters. Also, Joseph F. Smith's diaries after 1885, which his son's published biography quoted until 1916. Also, Matthias F. Cowley's bound diaries from the manifesto onward, and Apostle Francis M. Lyman's diaries to his death in 1916. Moreover, various families have, to my knowledge, preserved John W. Woolley's notebooks from 1902 to 1910, also Judson Tolman's notebooks from 1906 to 1916, and also a journal diary by President Taylor's young guard, Daniel R. Bateman, about 1886 and about the Woolleys during the 1920s. Both church custodians and family custodians have withheld from research other documents of similar importance. Still, I'll follow all the evidence available to me for two books I'm writing about post-manifesto developments. Existing sources that are currently being withheld won't answer every question, and they'll undoubtedly change some of my views, but researching them will resolve the main controversy about crucial events before 1920. 100 years have passed since then, and I hope all custodians of those documents feel secure enough in their faith to allow such research. Now, returning to this presentation's chronology, on 8 July 1912, according to her statement to police, Elders Quorum Secretary Howard N. Perkins and Jenny Tite were married polygamously in Salt Lake City, quote, by a man with a long white beard who told her that he was vested with authority from the Mormon Church, unquote. Photos of John W. Woolley from this time period show him with a long white beard, and he was most likely the officiator in 1912. On September 19th or thereabout, when she was endowed in the Salt Lake Temple, Elders Quorum Counselor Rule J. Alder and second wife Ada Davis were married in Centerville, undoubtedly by John W. Woolley. On 6 October 1912, Lauren C. Woolley submitted to the Church Historian's Office a written account of events, quote, during the latter part of September 1886, while President John Taylor was staying at the home of my father, John W. Woolley, in Centerville, Davis County, Utah, including these statements, quote, the brethren were considerably agitated about this time over an agitation about plural marriage, and some were insisting that the church issue some kind of a edict to be used in Congress concerning the surrendering of plural marriage. And at a meeting that afternoon, at which a number were present and myself, I heard President Taylor say, brethren, I will suffer my right hand to be cut off before I sign such a document. Unquote. On 31 January 1913, local 70s instructor Adolphus D. Rogers and second wife Mary Eliza Rowley were married in the Salt Lake Temple by Woolley. I have found no explanation for why he began performing polygamous ceremonies inside the temple. On March 14th, formerly stake president Reuben G. Miller and third wife Emma Nancy Crossland Mills were married in the Salt Lake Temple by Woolley. Quote, Brother Miller explained that Brother Woolley had told him how President Taylor had stayed at his home one night at the time of the abolishing of plural marriage was being agitated by the legal advisors of the church, and how President Taylor had spent the entire night in pondering over the question, and in the morning came into the room where Brother Woolley was, with his President Taylor's face illuminated, and said this principle was not to be done away with, but to remain on the earth, and that it had strengthened Brother Woolley in believing that the practice should be maintained, unquote. Thus, March 1913 is the earliest known date, by my research, when John W. Woolley claimed the 1886 revelation was his authority for performing polygamous marriages after the Second Manifesto. On March 21st, when she was endowed, local 70s quorum secretary Nathan G. Clark and second wife Cleo Afton Call were married in the Salt Lake Temple by Woolley. On March 21st, local 70 Israel Yates and second wife Marinda Vallette Hargraves were married in the Salt Lake Temple by Woolley, witnessed by the previous couple. On September 20th, formerly 70, local 70s president Joseph A. Silver and third wife Laura Blanche Clark Cook were married in the Salt Lake Temple by Woolley, apparently the first ceremony he performed since his ordination as stake patriarch on June 28th. On 28 December 1913, John W. Woolley was, quote, honorably released, unquote, from Davis Stakes High Council. And as the saying goes, the rest is history. Thank you. Now, we have a few minutes for Q&A, but before we start that, I have my email address up there on the board, mike.quinn@finefriends.net. This presentation drops a third of my findings about John W. Woolley. If you would like a full version of what I have found on John W. Woolley, send me a request to that email address, and I'll, by the end of August, when I'm back in Southern California, I'll be able to send a PDF of it to any who request. Also, I gave a shortened version of similar one detail after another about Lauren Woolley from 1886 to the time he gave his statement to church headquarters in October 1912. And if you would like a copy of Lauren's chronology during those years, then also specify that, and I will also send that to you. And now you can come to the microphone, ask questions, and we'll continue.
Mike, just by way of summary, could you please just kind of quickly go over the main points of what Lauren Woolley later claimed and which ones you think sound plausible and which ones you think sound implausible?
Okay. I only referred to these as miraculous events, but John W. Woolley in the 1920s claimed to fellow Mormons who were primarily unexcommunicated members of the church, although some had been excommunicated, in private meetings during the 1920s, he made claims about several miraculous events. Aside from the appearance of Joseph Smith as a resurrected person, when this commissioning allegedly occurred in 1886, Lauren claimed that President Taylor levitated off the floor of the house about 3 feet. He also claimed that the ordination, or rather the revelation that his father received, was accompanied by the appearance of Jesus Christ, as well as Joseph Smith, to his father, John Taylor. I found no contemporary, by contemporary I mean pre-1920, statements in support of those kinds of claims. Lauren Woolley also made claims about himself and his activities as a U.S. Secret Service agent and in other areas. Those I have not found pre-1920s verification for. But the ones that do have at least supporting evidence beginning in 1887, I have quoted. I haven't concealed anything I have found, but I haven't found anything that supports some of those claims that Lauren Woolley made to his listeners in the 1920s and to 1930s. He died in 1934. Okay. Yes.
It's been my observation that Francis Lyman, after testifying before the Senate Select Committee, was really adamant in stopping plural marriage following the Little Earth Second Manifesto in 1904. What sort of interaction did Francis Lyman have with John W. Woolley in that period from 1904 to, well, later in the 1910s?
Well, I haven't had access to John W. Woolley's notebook, as it's described only as a notebook, that has entries from 1902 to 1910. So that side has not been available to me, nor has Lyman's diary, Francis M. Lyman's diary, been available to me after the 1880s. I saw it up until the 1880s. He kept a very detailed daily diary. I saw excerpts from it, particularly concerning the resignations of John W. Taylor and Matthias F. Kelly from the Quorum of the Twelve in October 1905. And he, unlike others, and he had told others not to write anything about it, he wrote about it in detail. And one of his devout friends copied that into his diary, and I read his diary's quotes from Francis M. Lyman's diary about October 1905 and those meetings. Beyond that, I have not read Lyman's diary, so I have no direct knowledge either from the Woolley side or from the Lyman side about any interactions they might have had until the investigation by the Quorum of the Twelve of John W. Woolley in January 1914. And those minutes of those meetings and those interactions and those words spoken, I have read in the minutes of the Quorum of the Twelve. Oh, yeah. Yeah, but the important sources that I've mentioned will fill in many of the gaps. I'm sure they won't answer all my questions, and they'll, and as I said, undoubtedly will change some of my views. But I think those have the potential, and I think the actuality of answering many of my questions and your questions about pre-1920 events, particularly those that occurred from September 1886 onward.
My question is concerning the role of Joseph F. Smith during all this, because when he went back in front of the Senate and promised that he didn't know of any post-manifesto polygamy, they didn't believe him. But when he issued the second manifesto, the Senate, with a little encouragement from Theodore Roosevelt, said, "Looks like President Smith has cleaned house." And I think that had a referral to John W. Taylor being released.
And Cowley.
Yeah, and Cowley. So my question is, how could President Smith do all that and be that anxious about our new apostle senator, Reed Smoot, being seated and having represent Utah? How could he, and also Joseph F. Smith during this time, was, to my understanding, cooperating with the law in arresting polygamists. So was he living some kind of a double life, letting it occur, and yet supposedly working so hard to stop it?
Joseph F. Smith was the most complex and controversial, in my view, president of the church next to Joseph Smith, Jr. In the 1880s, he wrote an editorial and published it in the Deseret News about the denials of polygamy that were occurring by Joseph Smith and Hiram Smith in Nauvoo, even though they were marrying plural wives themselves, having sexual relations with those plural wives, and performing ceremonies for others who also entered into real marriages with multiple wives. And his explanation was as follows, in short. He said that when Jesus took Peter, James, and John to the Mount of what is called the Mount of Transfiguration, and Jesus talked to two angelic persons. When he came down from the mountain top, he told Peter, James, and John to tell no man about what they had seen and about what had happened until after Jesus was resurrected. And then Joseph F. Smith's editorial posited the question, what if the Apostle James had told a dear friend that this had occurred? What would Peter and John have to do? Confirm that he was telling the truth as an apostle, that James was telling the truth? And Joseph F. Smith's answer was that because of the covenant that Jesus put them under to tell no man, their only choice would to be to denounce James as a liar. Well, when Joseph F. Smith was president, in fact, before that, when he was a counselor in the first presidency, I have diary references of his advising men about their plans to marry post-manifesto wives. This occurs from 1894 until he became president in 1891. And then as president in 1891, I have diary references of his advising apostles about their upcoming plural marriages. And yet, when he spoke to the Quorum of the Twelve in their Thursday meetings in the temple, he said to them, I have never given permission for anyone to give plural marriage or to enter into plural marriage, and any man who says otherwise is a liar. And in front of him was Matthias F. Cowley, John W. Taylor, Abraham O. Woodruff, and others whom he had authorized within the 12 not only to marry plural wives themselves, but to perform plural marriages. And as I've quoted, after he issued the second manifesto, he privately gave permission for violations of his own second manifesto. But when people asked him about it, he said, I have never given permission, and if any man says I have, he is a liar. Well, think back to that 1880s information or essay that he had written. Joseph F. Smith had two priorities as an apostle and as, from 1880 onward, a member of the first presidency, first as a counselor and then as president of the church from 1901 to 1918. His first priority was to protect the church and its members. The second priority was to promote plural marriage and to be sure that it never died out among the Latter-day Saints, whom he was honor-bound to protect. And that required him to lie face-to-face to his dear friend, Francis M. Lyman, and to other members of the 12 who were opposed to post-manifesto plural marriage or felt uncomfortable with it, and at the same time that he would advise other members of the Quorum of the Twelve and First Presidency in this meeting in the 1912 diary, he said, I can't even talk to Francis M. Lyman about these things. But his counselor Anton H. Lund, President Smith told this diarist, he and I understand one another about these things. Well, Anton H. Lund had performed two plural marriages on the aboard ship in 1897 and 1898, and had been the go-between for the correspondence after the second after their second manifesto marriage, the correspondence between the plural wife that Apostle Roger Clausen married 4 months after the second manifesto. So yes, they had an understanding. They knew. And that understanding excluded Francis M. Lyman, who regarded Joseph F. Smith as nearly godlike, as his dearest friend. And yet he could not believe anytime anyone told him, in Quorum of the Twelve meetings, that Joseph F. Smith had authorized the individual to perform a post-manifesto or a post-1904 marriage. Francis M. Lyman simply couldn't accept mentally the fact that had happened, and that Joseph F. Smith had told him repeatedly the opposite. But that was the confusion and the varying conflicting obligations that Joseph F. Smith was in and was living and was perpetuating. So I am not sure. I know that up until 1912, he was still authorizing plural marriages. I'm not sure that you can exclude this double direction of Joseph F. Smith's words and actions until he died.
Do you know maybe why he didn't confide in Francis Lyman?
Well, Francis Lyman was uncomfortable with plural marriage, but not too uncomfortable to perform one himself, actually two. And so you have these varying doublethink ideas that operate. I mean, that's a phrase that comes much, much later, decades later, or cognitive dissonance that I had to operate with post-manifesto polygamy. In many ways, it's a mirror image of Nauvoo polygamy, where that same kind of double dealing, if you want to say it, or same kind of double thinking occurred between those who knew of the plural marriages that were occurring and then yet denied it in private and sometimes in public. So that's my only explanation. Could you come to the microphone and ask your question? Just for the benefit of those who are being recorded.
Wasn't Richard R. Lyman Francis Lyman's son?
Yes. And there are ironies here.
Yeah. And of course, he married Mrs. Jacobson. Yeah, he married Mrs. Jacobson. I can't remember if it was 1918 or
November 1925 is the date that Richard R. Lyman gave.
And he served in the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles until 1943, as I recall.
When they were discovered in her bedroom.
And with a smashed door raid with Joseph Fielding Smith and Harold B. Lee, right?
Correct.
So that wasn't in...
But they were in their set... Well, no, but that's because it's beyond 1913. I ended my presentation in 1913.
Okay.
We'd like him to.
I had one question. When you talked about Peter, James, and John, I missed the details of who did what and the other two apostles had to do.
Well, all three were told, tell no man. And Joseph F. Smith made the, you know, we would call it a thought experiment. That's what Einstein called his relativity theories coming from thought experiments. And with Joseph Fielding or Joseph F. Smith, the thought experiment that he said was, well, what if James had confided to a dear friend that Jesus had met Elias or Elijah and Moses on the Mount? What would John and Peter have to have done.
The way. Okay, thanks.
Okay, we're out of time. So if you have questions afterwards, we won't be at the microphone, but I'll be up here and sitting, resting my back and my tongue. And you're welcome to ask me anything you want.